Behind me is a poster of the wall, and as with most maps of anything regarding Israel and Palestine, it can be complicated, but perhaps you can see the lime green areas. Well, perhaps you can see a kidney bean shape. That's the West Bank. Inside of that, you may see lime green areas. Those would be the part of the West Bank that would be on the Palestinian on the Palestinian side of the wall, still occupied by Israel, but on the Palestinian side of the wall. So you can see that the wall is annexing about 40 to 55% of the West Bank, which is 22% of historic Palestine. The wall is 300 to 500 feet wide, and it consists of lots of different things. It's either a fence or a concrete wall, depending on where you are. The fence has electronic sensors. The concrete wall has these gun emplacement watchtowers every 325 yards with cameras and electric weapons that shoot at movement. And there are stories of these guns already shooting into schoolyards because they come that close to population centers. And the schoolyards are, of course, Palestinian. There's also a ditch up to 4 meters deep, a two-lane asphalt patrol road for the Israeli army to patrol, a trace road that they will sweep clean every day. I've seen this on the Jordanian-Israeli border. A strip of sand so that they sweep it clean so then you can see footprints if anyone's tried to cross, running parallel to the fence. Stacks of barbed wire, and somebody mentioned depth barriers. I don't know. They sound like landmines to me. I'm not sure what they are. When complete, as I said, the wall will annex about 55% more of the West Bank to Israel, and it will divide Palestinians into several different ghettos because there are several places where the wall completely encircles Palestinian communities. And so you will see sometimes some graffiti on the wall that will say things like, "Welcome to Abu Dis Ghetto," things like that. They're calling themselves ghettos. Or Bantustans, of course, you could call them. In addition to building the wall, Israel has created a new legal administrative regime, and this term administrative regime comes up in the ICJ decision. Originally, they were called, I think, seam zones, these places that are now completely surrounded by the wall, or they're on the Israeli side of the wall, but they're still in occupied territory. So the Palestinians living there are not Israeli citizens. They're occupied. They're citizens of nowhere. They now have a new administrative regime. And here's what the ICJ says about this, and I'm going to quote. There's been a creation, quote, of a new administrative regime. Thus, in October 2003, the Israeli Defense Forces issued orders establishing the part of the West Bank lying between the Green Line and the wall as a closed area, so on the Israeli side of the wall. Residents of this area may no longer remain in it, nor may non-residents enter it, unless holding a permit or identity card issued by the Israeli authorities. According to the report of the UN Secretary General, most residents have received permits for a limited period. Israeli citizens, Israeli permanent residents, and those eligible to immigrate to Israel in accordance with the law of return may remain in or move freely to, from, and within the closed area without a permit. Access to and exit from the closed area can only be made through access gates, which are opened infrequently and for short periods. That would be like if all of you in your homes were issued temporary permits to reside there, permits that could be taken away at any time, and people who had perhaps never set foot in Canada before were now told you may freely move in and about your home. This is when they talk about people who are eligible for the law of return, they're talking about Jews from all over the world who may never have gone to Israel before, who can, by landing at the airport in Israel and by claiming this right, this law of return right, they can receive instant, almost instant, Israeli citizenship. They can now move into these closed areas where Palestinians who've lived there for generations may not be able to move freely about these areas anymore. What are some of the impacts on the people, land, water, and communities, according to the ICJ decision? This will affect about 875,000 Palestinians, or about 35 to 40% of the Palestinians in the occupied territories. Broken down, 237,000 Palestinians will now be living in areas totally cut off by the wall from the rest of the occupied territories. 160,000 other people will live in almost completely encircled communities. Another 400,000 will be divided from their land, their jobs, education opportunities, or the health clinic where they go. The most fertile land has been placed on the Israeli side of the wall. And again, when I say Israeli side of the wall, I'm not talking about inside Israel. I'm talking about in the occupied territories, Palestinian land, but on the west side of the Israeli wall. And the most important water wells of the occupied territories are now on that side. Hundreds of thousands of fruit trees have been uprooted or killed. There's an illegal tree selling industry now in Israel. Hothouses has been confiscated, upon which tens of thousands of Palestinians rely for their survival. Over 10,000 grazing animals are losing their grazing land. Over 2,000 tons of olive oil per season will be destroyed. 100,000 tons of vegetables, 50 tons of fruit. The list sort of goes on. Israel has annexed most of the Western aquifer system, providing, according to the International Court of Justice, providing 51% of the West Bank water. PENGAN, the Palestinian Environmental Network of groups, whose multimedia presentation you saw as you walked in, says that 89% of the available water will be out of reach of Palestinians. I didn't have time to figure out where those numbers diverge, but 51% is still way too much of the water to be taking. I'm going to give you a couple of examples of communities and how they've been hit by the wall. Qalqilya is one that many of you may have heard of. Qalqilya is a town of 40,000 people. There's now one door for them to get into their town. It's open from 7 in the morning till 7 at night. I took my daughter to an emergency room a couple of, on Halloween night. I took her there at 8 in the evening because the on-call nurse told me to. She had pneumonia. If I were living right outside the Qalqilya wall and needed to get my daughter to the emergency room in the hospital in Qalqilya after 7 p.m., I'd be out of luck. In fact, the hospital in Qalqilya is seeing 40% fewer patients. 6,000 to 8,000 people have already left the region. This is not slow ethnic cleansing. 600 businesses have already shut down. The special rapporteur from the UN, who's the special rapporteur for the Commission on Human Rights on the situation in the occupied territories, is John Dugard, who's a South African who was also on the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. He's called the situation in Palestine an apartheid worse than in South Africa. Jayus is an area near Qalqilya. 72% of that village's land has been confiscated. There's a gate that can let people in to go to their land that's on the other side of the wall. The gate opens for 10 minutes at 6:30 in the morning, 12:30, and 4:30 in the afternoon, maybe. Occasionally it opens at random times. It's only open for 10 minutes, so if you miss that time, you can't go in, get to your livestock and feed them or water them. You can't go in and deal with your hothouses or tend to your trees. There used to be 168 greenhouses in that area on the Israeli side of the wall. Now there are only 82. The owners have found that they either don't have water, they don't have workers, or they just don't want to face the soldiers at least twice a day. The whole village of Jayus used to drive water tanks to their reservoir, which is now on the other side of the wall, and bring the water tanks back to their village. That's how they got their water. Now there's a law that says that their water tanks aren't allowed to cross the wall. How are they supposed to get water? They're trying to figure it out. This village, just in case, you know, some people have this idea somehow that the region is desert. I don't think people would be fighting over it quite as hard if it were. No offense to deserts. But these folks grow figs, pecans, avocados, grapes, loquat, walnut, pomegranate, citrus trees, and olives. This is a very rich area, and they're being separated from it. All right, so what's happening is that the wall is speeding up the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians from the occupied territories, and it's the clearest annexation of land other than East Jerusalem that Israel has engaged in. On July 9th of 2004, this year, the International Court of Justice gave its opinion that the wall and its administrative regime, those laws that give people temporary permits, etc., were illegal under international law. This was an advisory opinion. It was requested from the ICJ by the UN General Assembly. which had an emergency session, which they called because this was an issue affecting peace and security in the world, which couldn't move through the Security Council because of a veto of one permanent member of the Security Council. One guess as to which that member was. United States of America. Thank you. Ironically, this idea that the UN General Assembly can send something to, can have an emergency session on an issue if the Security Council can't do anything about it, ironically, this is called the Uniting for Peace Resolution. And it was begun and spearheaded by the US during the Cold War when they felt that the Soviet Union was vetoing things that they liked. So back at you, United States. And there's sort of a long question that the General Assembly sent to the ICJ, which basically came down to what are the legal consequences arising from the construction of the wall. Israel objected that the International Court of Justice didn't have jurisdiction to consider the case, but the ICJ said that it did, unanimously, by the way, 15-0. The ICJ said that it had no good reason to not give its opinion, that it had plenty of facts, some of which had even been given by Israel. What Israel did was it submitted legal briefs on the process, but not on the merits of the case. And it didn't actually stand up and argue, but it did submit written briefs. And the ICJ also noted, and this will answer the leaflets, which I didn't see at the top of the stairs, it noted that while the advisory opinion doesn't have the force of law, it is a helpful tool to the General Assembly and the Security Council. That's what it's there for, and so that's why the ICJ was going to give it. It also stated that although Israel did have legitimate security concerns, as every nation does, the wall was not a legitimate way to meet those concerns and needs. Listing the very specific details that I already gave you, the ICJ noted, or based its advisory opinion, on the following sort of general categories: destruction and requisition of properties by the wall, restrictions on the freedom of movement of inhabitants of the occupied Palestinian territory, impediments to the exercise by those concerned of the right to work, the right to health, the right to freedom from hunger, the right to protection and assistance for family and children, the right to education, the right to an adequate standard of living, and the right to self-determination. Based on that, the ICJ held sort of seven basic points. The wall should be torn down. Sorry, they didn't hold. This was their advisory opinion. The wall should be torn down. The administrative regime should end, so all laws enabling the wall to happen should be withdrawn. All the victims of the wall should be given compensation or had their property returned, whatever could be done. The UN General Assembly and Security Council should take further action to end the wall and its associated regime. It also stated that not only is the wall difficult for Palestinians, but it's so difficult that it impinges on the Palestinian right to self-determination. And that right is something that every country has a duty to uphold, the right to self-determination. Whatever treaty it's signed or not signed, every nation should be upholding the right to self-determination for every other peoples. And in this case, therefore, it doesn't matter what treaties Canada has signed or not signed. Canada has the duty to uphold the right to self-determination. Canada's probably signed a whole bunch of treaties that say that in writing, but if they haven't, it's there, even despite the absence of treaties. It also stated that all signers of the Fourth Geneva Convention must ensure respect for the Fourth Geneva Convention. Canada has signed the Fourth Geneva Convention. And it stated that the UN General Assembly should encourage the establishment of a Palestinian state as soon as possible, existing next to Israel on the basis of international law.